Welcome to History Unpacked, formerly English Through History. Recently, I had the special opportunity to speak with writer and historian Robert B. O'Connor, author of the book Jeep Show, A Trooper at the Battle of the Bulge. The book showcases a unique take on World War II history and is available at the website jeepshowbook.com, Amazon, or bookshop.org. Links in the description. In our interview, Mr. O'Connor talked about just what a Jeep Show was, the Battle of the Bulge, assorted bits of World War II trivia, and the life of black soldiers during the war, among many other things. A quick note, some listeners may notice a bit of distortion with the sound quality. This is my fault, and though I checked the settings beforehand, a few unresolved technical issues got in the way. That being said, it's a great interview, so definitely give it a listen. Bob starts by giving an overview of his book.
The main character of Jeep Show was inspired by an actual person. I was researching a second nonfiction book, and I came across the story of a real person named Jim Hetzer. And Jim Hetzer has died a long time ago, but I managed to get in touch with one of his daughters. She said, "Were you aware that my father was an enlisted entertainer in World War II?" And I said, no, tell me about that. I didn't know there were enlisted entertainers in World War II. So she told me about Jim Hetzer's war and the fact that he worked with Mickey Rooney in the war. And she also told me that Jim Hetzer's older sister, her aunt, had saved every letter he wrote home from the European Theater of Operations. Primary source, Eric, primary sources. So, and actually those letters had been published in a book on that was available on Amazon. So I read those and found some other primary sources. Why I decided to write a novel, I'm not sure. perhaps it was just the challenge. I knew I wanted to involve the Battle of the Bulge, the largest battle ever fought by the United States Army. And this real person had come close to it, but had not been involved. So that's the basis of the book, was inspired by a fascinating war experience of a real person, and then adding other aspects onto it to try to give readers, especially readers who might be a little bit intimidated by all the excellent nonfiction books about World War II, and to try to give them, within the context of weaving a story, to try to give them a lot of facts about what it was like for the ground level combat soldiers and their direct supporters during the war.
Yeah, and it is. I think you accomplished that. It was entertaining to read, but again, like, there's just really, like, every page is just packed with history. And it's interesting reading it from this character's point of view, because he's kind of a, well, yeah, as you said, he's an entertainer. He's an average guy. He's not, a proficient warrior, and he just gets thrown into this, savage environment. Yes. And, yes. And so, like, the reader can really identify with it, and it's frightening. Yes. At times, really.
Yes. During the Battle of the Bulge, many rear echelon and not combat experienced soldiers were called to duty, especially during the siege of Bastogne. And, they had basic training, and they had been trained how to shoot a rifle, and they acquitted themselves admirably doing that. But certainly it must have been a strange experience for them, and harrowing.
I then went on to ask Bob exactly what a Jeep Show was. He explained that while the military employed special troops for the purposes of putting on shows for the morale and entertainment of other troops, Some areas were too dangerous for a typical show. To this end, they deployed small groups of entertainers in jeeps, jeep shows. These men would risk their own lives for the morale of U.S. troops.
I would say first that, as in real life, the main character enlists and he wants to be a paratrooper. He wants that glory, and the Army had classification tests, and they quickly dismissed his idea of being a paratrooper. And based on his show business experience, his minor league show business experience, I should add, they give him military occupation specialty 442, which is entertainment specialist. The Army did quite a bit of morale-related programs. For rear echelon soldiers, especially soldiers in training camps in the U.S., they were trying to keep the soldiers from getting completely bored, going off base, going to bad parts of neighboring towns, and coming back in trouble. And then for combat soldiers on the front lines, they developed jeep shows. And jeep shows were actually developed by a famous Broadway director named Joshua Logan. Joshua Logan directed South Pacific, among other huge hits. Gifted man. He was, I believe, a major in the Morale Corps, which is the structure that these enlisted men were in. They came over as part of a big show with an orchestra and, a big cast. And they got to Paris, and the Army, as it often does, without telling them, broke up the show and put them all in jeep shows. The concept of jeep shows was combat infantry soldiers do not get USO shows. They don't get Red Cross donuts and coffee. It is too dangerous and too far away. The only way to reach them with live entertainment would be to put three of these enlisted entertainers in a jeep and drive them up to, oh, half a mile behind the front lines. And you know, these combat troops would rotate out for a hot meal, possibly even a uniform exchange, and they'd get this live show. And there's something very, very important to people under duress, such as combat infantry, with live entertainment, because when you're in combat infantry, usually you're far in advance of most of your colleagues. You're under great duress, the threat of wounds and death. You're usually in great discomfort. You're on the front lines. You're sleeping on the ground. You're eating K rations for the most part, which are very boring after a while. So the idea of physically showing up and being there is a big morale boost. And they loved the show. The show was sort of a variety show based on vaudeville. So, the main character is in a jeep show squad with Mickey Rooney, which reflects what really happened. And they sing. There's a company of soldiers, 90 or so soldiers watching, and they'll sing some songs. They'll tell some jokes. They'll dance a little. They'll pull a soldier out of the audience who might, do a good impression of Edward G. Robinson or Jimmy Cagney, and do a show. And that's appreciated. But also what's appreciated is they hang around afterwards and talk with the soldiers and, have a cup of coffee and a cigarette. So that was the concept of jeep shows. They were very successful. And indeed, on the back cover of the book, I reproduce an actual memo from a general of several divisions who is saying, these were great, much appreciated, please send us more. So it turned out to be a very successful concept. Interestingly, Eric, we all know about Mickey Rooney, who was an enlisted entertainer. And if you read my book, you know about Jim Tanzer, the enlisted entertainer. Some of the other names of enlisted entertainers were not famous at the time, as Jim Tanzer was not famous, but went on to me. So for example, went on to be. So Mel Brooks was MOS 442.
Oh, wow.
Sammy Davis Jr., who in his own way might have been the first soldier to integrate the U.S. Army, because he the Army was segregated in World War II, and yet Sammy Davis Jr. was in a Jeep Show squad with white soldiers. So that's a possible theory. I wouldn't want to defend that necessarily against a historian of the Army, but those of us my age know the name Red Buttons. Red Buttons was a very successful comedian in the 50s and 60s. He was an unknown entertainment soldier during the war. Burt Lancaster, Dick Van Dyke, Burl Ives, Joey Bishop. So it turned out to be sort of the minor leagues from which sprung some very notable entertainers after the war.
One soldier employed as a Jeep Show entertainer during the war was Mickey Rooney, a cornerstone of Hollywood. I asked Bob to give us a little more background about this legendary icon, after which point we returned to the topic of Jeep shows.
Mickey Rooney was the number one worldwide box office star in 1938 and 1939. His main vehicle were these Andy Hardy movies, a series of movies where he played a precocious, talented teenager. Mickey Rooney was 5'1" tall and did very well in teenage roles into his mid-20s. He also played more serious roles, and several of his directors said that he was the most talented actor they had ever worked with. My opinion, I've researched that part of his career, is he was a genius. Like many geniuses, he had incredible areas of weakness, and his weakness was his life off the movie set was a full-on 10 out of 10 scale party at all times. Eventually, I think that was that caught up with him. He enlisted in early 1944 under some pressure. By that time, male celebrities of draft age were under some pressure to enlist. Importantly, though, and I'm full of respect for Mickey Rooney, he could have done his service at the Hal Roach Studios in Hollywood. Important work doing films for the Army or the Navy. Lieutenant Ronald Reagan did his service at Hal Roach Studios. This would have been about 10 minutes from Mickey Rooney's home in Hollywood. He chose to go overseas he didn't know he would be doing Jeep shows, because, you know, when they went overseas, as I said, they were with one big show called Hip Hooray. But he chose to go overseas. In my mind, I think he was trying, perhaps unconsciously, to get away from the somewhat ruinous life that he was living. But, you know, to get back to your main point, he was a gigantic worldwide star when he was in the Army. Now, his star had probably started to fade a little. He did joke that, after he felt he was too old to play a teenager, he said, "I'm too short to be a leading man and too tall to be a producer." And that was a joke, but facing a very real career problem, which was he was not ever going to be a leading man.
Interesting. Yeah. And as you said, he does show up in the book a few times. And I really liked reading his lines of dialogue.
Yes.
They're legitimately funny. We'll talk about the dialogue a little bit later if we have time. So now these Jeep shows were, it seems like they were pretty dangerous for the performers, right? Because they were right there on the front lines, huh?
They were within artillery range, certainly, and sniper range. There's an example in the show where one of the officers of a unit they're visiting asked them to keep moving because of the possibility of snipers. So, yes, they were not, until the Battle of the Bulge, caught everybody up, they were not at the front line, you know, firing weapons at the enemy, but they were within artillery range. And, you know, driving around in the Jeep, especially at night, there was some danger of German saboteurs and you know, infiltration. So, yes, it certainly was risky. Not as risky as being a combat infantry soldier, but, you know, for an entertainer, yes.
Yeah, and do you think has there ever been any sort of, you know, a portrayal of these Jeep shows in like media, you know, other books, movies, that sort of thing? Or do you think your book is pretty much the first example to kind of touch on this topic?
Well, I think it is. I have talked to in the course of writing this book and then promoting it, I've talked to many, many people who study World War II and who are deeply interested in World War II. And to a person, they are all surprised to learn about the existence of Jeep shows. So I think it is the first book to deal with it. It's a fascinating topic because it involves 20th century show business, with, of course, the huge event of World War II. But I have not run across another person that knows about it.
Bob's book is not only a history of the Jeep Show, but also of the Battle of the Bulge, the largest single battle of World War II. In fact, this winter marks the 80th anniversary of this important conflict. Let's listen.
One thing we have to understand is it occurred over an 84-mile front of mostly Luxembourg and Belgium. It is the largest battle ever fought by the U.S. Army. It was launched by the Germans on December 16th, 1944. It was in many ways a desperate gamble by Hitler to change the course of the war, which by this time it was very clear that Germany was going to lose. So Hitler's plan was to launch a surprise attack west and divide up the American and British armies. Recapture the crucial port of Antwerp in Holland, and then get a negotiated peace with the theoretically demoralized Allies so that Hitler could turn all his forces to the east to resist the Soviets, who were inexorably heading towards Berlin. Hitler's top generals did not like the plan, disagreed with it, asked for, you know, a smaller achievable plan. The plan was audacious and probably had about a 3% chance of succeeding. By September of 1944, the American armies and the British army had advanced further and faster than was planned and were literally on the German border. There was a very bloody stalemate, if you will, fought at the Hürtgen Forest with the Germans, which is in the Ardennes as well. By mid-December 1944, the U.S. First Army had four divisions spread along the Luxembourg and Belgium border with Germany. Theoretically, they were there to, you know, guard the border. We were not planning on further attacks until after the winter. They were spread very thin. A couple of the divisions were very inexperienced. A couple of the divisions, particularly the 28th Infantry Division, had been at the Hürtgen Forest and was essentially resting and refitting in what was thought to be a quiet sector. The Germans assembled about 200,000 troops and 1,000 tanks. They managed to keep it reasonably secret. The specific attack was not expected and certainly not in that strength. There were about 83,000 American soldiers in the area. The battle was marked by very harsh winter conditions, snow, freezing temperatures. And the Germans, the reason it's called the Battle of the Bulge is, and of course that was a newspaperman nickname, the Germans made a front in the middle of their attack. They got about 50 miles west. The weather was very overcast during the first few days of the battle, so the Allies' complete air superiority could not be brought into play. Now, again, you know, at some point the weather's going to clear, and it did. Substantial casualties, about 19,000 Americans killed, about 50,000 wounded, about 23,000 missing or captured. German losses were about twice that. And then the battle did not end, although by about December 28th or 29th, it was obvious the German attack had been stalled and the Germans began retreating, a fighting retreat, typical of the German army. And the battle did not end fully until January 25th.
All right. Yeah. So the Battle of the Bulge actually happened around, you know, the time it is now, right? This is we're doing this interview in January. So yes. And I believe we're currently celebrating like the anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge at this time.
Yes, it's right? The 80th. This year would be the 80th anniversary, and there are, you know, one thing that's interesting is many World War II veterans were present in some way at the Battle of the Bulge because it was the largest battle ever fought by the U.S. Army. So there are still a few living veterans who were involved in the Battle of the Bulge. And I know I was talking to one of them that went to Bastogne this year.
Wow.
And was celebrated and honored at Bastogne. The civilians of Belgium and Luxembourg in particular remain deeply grateful to the United States Army for pushing the Germans out of their lands.
Now, when you say it was the biggest battle, do you mean like in terms of area, in terms of, you know, personnel involved or both?
Both.
Okay.
And certainly personnel involved, but no, both. Again, this front was 85 miles long. The Germans attacked with three armies, the 6th SS Panzer Army, the 5th Panzer Army, and the 7th Army, which was Volksgrenadiers. And so they attacked at the top of this 85-mile front, right in the middle of it, and then at the bottom of the 85-mile front. And the German army at the bottom of the 80-mile front was there to screen against Patton's Third Army coming up from the south, because Patton's Third Army was fighting in southern France and moving north, and they were actually planning, I have learned, to attack in Germany on the 19th of December. So when in the south, the Saar, and when it became apparent that this German attack on the 16th was not just a spoiling attack, but was a large, significant attack, Patton spoke with Eisenhower and turned his army north and, you know, made significant speed to attack the Germans' southern flank and actually liberate, as part of that, he lifted the siege of Bastogne. So three German armies, 100,000 or so American soldiers over an 84-mile front, and eventually in bitter cold and snow, eventually. So yes, the largest action ever fought by the U.S. Army.
And I know that there was a famous incident where the Germans, they asked for the you know, surrender of the Allies, and General, you'll have to help me with the pronunciation.
Yeah.
Is it McAuliffe?
McAuliffe, that's it. Okay. That's it.
Yeah, he gave a famous response. I think it was one word, right? Nuts.
Yes.
Now, in that case, did the Germans that must have been a bluff, right? They probably realized at that point they were going to lose this offensive.
Let me, that's a very good question. Let me put a little perspective on it. In the initial 4 or 5 days of the attack, what the Americans were fighting for, they were giving up men and territory to gain time. The Germans, again, with this very audacious and, you know, highly speculative large attack, had to stick to a rapid timetable. If nothing else, eventually the skies would clear and the American air superiority would come into play. So what the American forces did in the desperate first 3 or 4 days is they stood their ground where they could as long as they could, even though they were outnumbered, and then gave up ground and moved back and made another stand. Bastogne was very important to the Germans because it was the hub of 7 paved roads, because it had been a great tourist town before the war. And the German tanks could not move on anything but roads. They were too heavy. So Bastogne was crucial to the German plans and timetable. Because of the courageous delaying actions, which my protagonist gets dragged into several times, the 101st Airborne Division, the famous Band of Brothers from the TV miniseries, was able to get into Bastogne and defend it. So Bastogne became surrounded. The general who was on the spot and in command, General McAuliffe, formulated a very effective plan of defense, which essentially involved artillery gathered near the center of the area and firing as though, you know, around the faces of a clock, wherever the Germans would try to gather in strength, which you have to do to penetrate good defenses, they would come under artillery fire from the center of Bastogne. Bastogne was surrounded. The German commander of the force, and by the way, the Bastogne was surrounded by one German force, but the major German force kept moving west towards the Meuse River to stay on the timetable. Bastogne was surrounded. The German officer in charge of those forces submitted a written demand for surrender. As it turns out, his commanding officer was furious when he found out he had done this. This was an improvisation on the spot. General McAuliffe, who was, of course, as you'd imagine, working pretty much around the clock, was actually taking a short nap when his aide brought him this written German surrender. So he's half awake. He reads it. And he says, nuts, to it, just kind of off the cuff. And after a while, his aide says, what do you want me to, what do you want us to respond? And he says, nuts is good enough. So that did actually happen. And that's how it came about. And Bastogne was a very important disruption of the German timetable.
All right. So now correct me if I'm wrong here. Would it be safe to say that for Allied soldiers that were in the Battle of the Bulge, it would have been, you know, a different experience depending on what portion of that area you were in? Because it sounds like in the center of it, you know, where they were firing, you know, around, it was probably pretty action-packed. But then it kind of seemed, just from reading the book, I also gathered that there were other regions that were much more you know, just kind of waiting for, you know, to see what would happen, or they were just kind of digging in and biding their time. Is that sound accurate?
Well, I'd say this. There was tremendous resistance going on pretty much all along the front. And as we said, the front was pushing in the middle of the front. It was pushing in significantly. One reason why the bulge happened in the middle is there was very bitter fighting on what is called the northern shoulder, of that 83-mile front. And even though the Americans were eventually overwhelmed, they held out for the first 48 hours. Even though they were far outnumbered, they were able to hold out for 48 hours at a town called St. Vith in the northern shoulder. There was a little less bitter fighting in the southern shoulder. And then in the middle, as we talked about where the bulge was, everyone was, you know, standing, you know, resisting and then retreating. Much faster than at the northern shoulder and at the southern end of it. So everyone along the front, Eric, was very much involved in combat, stand and retreat, and as I said, successfully buying time by sacrificing men and equipment to keep the Germans off their timetable. Bastogne was, oh, about, I guess, 20 miles behind the front. And as the center bulge expanded, it expanded to Bastogne and beyond. As I said, you know, significant German forces bypassed Bastogne to continue west in their fruitless, you know, almost impossible quest to get to the Meuse River, cross the Meuse River, and get up to Antwerp.
And I think it's worth pointing out too that listeners who end up reading the book, do check out the website, jeepshowbook.com. It's got a lot of like photos and maps of, you know, all of the areas that the book talks about. It's really a good companion to the book, and definitely worth checking that out. It kind of gives you a visual of some of the places that are talked about, and really good photos.
In addition to the history of its subject content, Jeep Show also provides many looks at historical minutiae, small facts about everyday life in the early 20th century, both in and out of the war. I asked Bob to share his wealth of knowledge with us.
The Queen Mary was turned into a troop ship in 1939, when the British were first dragged into war. The Queen Mary carried 3,500 passengers in its civilian, you know, in its civilian days, and it carried 16,000 troops as a troop ship. My father went to the war in Europe on the Queen Mary, so I was very interested in what that experience was like. The Queen Mary did not travel in convoys to guard against German U-boats because the Queen Mary was so fast that it could easily outrun German U-boats who had to surface to fire. Nonetheless, you know, there was a chance that a U-boat could have come across it, you know, so the Queen Mary did not have enough fresh water. With 16,000 troops to have fresh water showers, but they had salt water showers, and regular soap does not work very well in salt water, and so the Queen Mary issued these Hershey's cocoa butter soap. In this incident that happens to the protagonist, Jim Tanzer, he gets caught in the shower during a U-boat drill. And has to run up on deck pretty much naked and stand at his station near the lifeboat. And his hair is full of lather from the salt water and the soap, and it hardens in place. Mickey Rooney is observing and thinking, oh my goodness, this scene needs to go in my next movie. I came across that story. It actually happened to a British soldier during the war, and I came across that story, and I thought it was so interesting and funny that I put it in the book. I will say I did a lot of research and had way too many details that I could use. So I got to pick from many, many details. And so I think the term is Easter eggs. People very interested in World War II have told me that, you know, they're just very pleased with finding these Easter eggs. I'll give you another example, Eric. The M1 Garand rifle that was the basic issue to all infantry soldiers was an automatic rifle, and you loaded a 9-round clip into it to fire it. The breech of the gun would pull back to load the clip, and then it would snap forward. When the clip was loaded, it would on its own snap forward very firmly. If you were inexperienced and you left your thumb trailing a bit behind the clip, it would snap forward on your thumb and was very painful, and would leave a very big bruise on your thumbnail. I don't mention M1 thumb by name, but several times Jim looks down at his thumb and regrets, does not love his M1 rifle the way his instructor might have wanted him to. So yeah, I tried to sprinkle some of these throughout the book, and what I found is the World War II buffs really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, I do remember that there is a line in there where, like, it says something about loving his rifle, and said Jim did not love his rifle.
Right.
Now I know why that is.
Yeah.
Another thing I thought was interesting is it mentioned that, like, you could tell the enlisted from the officers by looking at their helmets, because I believe the enlisted, they had like a bluish tint to the helmets because they would use it for cooking. Did I get that right?
Well, that is mostly right. The front, again, I was really wanted to emphasize the experience of frontline combat soldiers. You knew you were looking at a frontline combat soldier when you looked at his helmet and it had the bluish tinge, because they were issued little Coleman stoves that ran on what was called white gas, which we would call sterno now, I think. And they would use that to heat water for shaving, although when you're on the frontline combat, you're not too worried about shaving. They would use that to heat soup, to heat water for coffee. The K rations came with instant coffee packet and sugar. So, yeah, it wasn't so much the officers as it was, you know, combat frontline soldiers having to make do. Interestingly, the officers, you could tell their helmet. They did not, in the front line, the officers did not wear their rank on their uniforms because of snipers. So a lieutenant has two bars normally on his shoulder, two gold bars. There would be two white short stripes on the back of the lieutenant's helmet to indicate his rank, but no other signifiers.
Well, so one other thing too is, it might not also be evident to readers that a lot of, so we talked about Mickey Rooney, right?
Yes.
A real person. Jim Tanzer, who not based on a real person.
Yes.
But there are a lot of other characters that kind of come and go that readers might not realize were real people. Like, for example, I think they're in a tavern and there's an accordion player named, is it Gypsy Rose Blanchard?
There is a famous accordion player, and for some reason, early this morning, this is in Paris, because Jim Tanzer, the protagonist, on his way to the front, they stopped in Paris. Let me just get this. Gypsy Markov, Markoff.
Yeah, why did I say Blanchard? Yeah, Markov. Yeah.
Gypsy Markov was a pretty well-known performer, very beautiful, dark, raven-haired, actually an American, but because of her Russian immigrant parents, you would have thought she was a European, and she didn't mind people thinking that. A real person, did USO performances during the war, was actually in a very bad plane crash during her service in Europe and lost the use of several fingers on her keyboard hand. I think that is the left hand for most accordionists, and yet was still an excellent, excellent performer. Yes. So yes, there are a few real people sprinkled around around. And General McAuliffe in Bastogne makes a short appearance to, in a friendly way, order Jim Tanzer to put on a show for the wounded soldiers and civilians at Bastogne.
Yeah, and I think there's also a journalist. They call him I think Bunny Levin in the book, yeah. But that's a short for his real name. And on, I think it's your website, you actually have an article that he wrote.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. Bunny Levin is a creation of my mind. Uh-huh. I needed a journalist present gives a great way to give exposition of the big picture. So, you know, Jim and he run into each other. He, of course, as a reporter, is asking Jim all sorts of questions about his experience at Bastogne, thinking, Bunny is thinking, an enlisted entertainer fighting at Bastogne, this is going to be a great story. And then he also thinks, if only this were Mickey Rooney, it would be front page. So the reporter gives me the chance to give a lot of exposition about the battle in a way that is not it is not boring. I wrote at the end of the book, I wrote the reporter, and by the way, the reporter is also at the liberation of a concentration camp where Jim is. And then at the end of the book, I fabricated an article, a column that the reporter wrote in late 1945, early 1946, kind of describing the big picture of what happened after the war and all these refugees and how, you know, the disappointing things that happened in Germany and the good things. And then he gives a kind of tribute to the American soldier. And interestingly, Eric, that was at the end of the book and literally sort of an afterword. And my editor insisted that I had to remove it because even though he liked it, he really wanted the book to end on the train, you know, where Jim is on the train going home. So I stuck it on the website and I made it look as much as possible like an original typed document for authenticity. I just made that up. You know, I did so much research that I just had to, you know, get some of it down on paper. I think it's a very good overview on how a war correspondent would look back on the war, the positive things and the disappointing things that happened after the war.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool touches to the book like that. I also kind of liked the little kind of excerpts from the I think you call it the Morale Corps handbook.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, I think those are also you know, your own writing basically. Right.
Well, Eric, I will tell you with a little, I actually came across, speaking of primary sources, the actual manual for the Morale Corps for these entertainment soldiers. And it dealt with Jeep shows and it dealt with what were called soldier shows, where they would, in the rear echelons, they would put on amateur shows with a soldier crew and a soldier cast. So I had this book to go by. And so I selected excerpts from it, often edited it, but those were not creations completely out of my mind as was the war correspondence.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Those are interesting to read too. Like I think there's one in there about, you know, the handling of human remains, you know, like.
Yes. That was a different manual. That was the soldiers that dealt with the dead were, it was called graves registration, and a very difficult job recovering bodies. And I found the manual, the 1944 graves registration manual, and it was absolutely harrowing to read. But I did excerpt parts of it just to give readers, especially readers that aren't aware of of this, you know, just to give them that insight into the efforts it took to deal respectfully with all the dead. And there were so many, so many.
Lots of kind of interesting touches like that in the book. Well, let's see here. What else? So, yeah, I mentioned the dialogue earlier. I wanted to talk about that a little bit. How did you go about writing the dialogue? Because, you know, like a lot of people don't realize, you know, it's surprisingly difficult. You know, when we think about writing and stuff, you know, we always think about the plot, you know, development and this and that. But it's like, you know, getting realistic speaking for people of that time period is surprisingly hard. How did you come up? And there is a lot of really good dialogue in this. It's not just, you know, facts and things like that. It's people interacting with each other. How did you find inspiration for the you know, the talking and the interaction?
Yeah. Well, first of all, one of the things I learned, you know, when I started to write a novel is readers, if you write dense paragraphs, readers will skip ahead to the dialogue. So, you know, I tried to convey a lot of the important information and emotions via what characters said to each other. I wanted it to be authentic, or at least, you know, symbolic of how people talked in the late 30s and early 40s, and especially in the Army. I collected slang from that period, the way you might collect stamps or coins. You know, I just, as I would run across slang in my reading, I kept a list of it. Secondly, I watched several movies from the period, and I read several books from the period. In particular, the book, the detective books about Philip Marlowe, one of them is the famous The Big Sleep, which became a Humphrey Bogart film. I read several of these detective, I think it's called noir. I think that's, you know, and they're full of slang and idioms and all that. So I just kept a long list of that. And, you know, without overdoing it, I put them in the dialogue, and you know, if there was one word that came through to me as the way people talked back then, the word swell, S-W-E-L-L. People used the word swell all the time back then, and we don't use it at all now. Yeah. So I think swell appears half a dozen times.
Yeah.
I lived in England for a year, and I've always kind of had an ear for, and then, you know, English accents. So there are several times with crew members on the Queen Mary troop ship and other times where I'm able to pick up on a Cockney accent. And you know, for me, that was fun and interesting to put in. But I think the main point is, I really tried to use dialogue to reveal, you know, how the characters were feeling, the key points about it, and thus, if I was going to use that much dialogue, it was important, and it was painstaking to try to make it how people spoke back then. Now, it's not an exact replica of how people spoke back then. I think if I've succeeded, it is just reminiscent of how people spoke.
Yeah, it's probably impossible to get an exact replication.
Right.
I remember there was one movie. I think it was the remake of True Grit with Jeff Bridges.
Ah,
and
yes.
They never talk with contractions in that. And I seem to remember reading somewhere that people really didn't talk that way back in the Wild West.
Yeah.
They actually used contractions quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I don't
yes.
know. That's just what I heard. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
But yeah, it just goes to show you, you know, how, you know, even, you know, some of the big Hollywood directors and so on, you know, have a hard time with this.
One interesting facet of World War II that we often forget about is the place of the Black American soldier during the war. being someone who was technically a free American citizen, yet often not treated as such, meant that the wartime experience of the black man was different from that of his fellow soldier. This was the final topic that we talked about before concluding the interview.
A very interesting question, and I thought a lot about that. And I wanted to show things about that because, in my independent opinion, you know, as an amateur historian, the American civil rights movement of the 20th century is one of the top five or six worldwide events. The black soldier experience in World War II was segregated. The army was completely segregated. There were no, leaving Sammy Davis Jr. and his Jeep show aside, there were no integrated units at all. Almost all black soldiers and sailors were put in support roles. Truck drivers, the black soldiers were the drivers in the famous Red Ball Express, getting supplies off the beaches of Normandy and into Europe. Support roles in the Navy, they were stewards and cooks. So largely kept out of combat. There were a few combat units of black soldiers, but they had white officers. The 969th Artillery Battalion, which features heavily in one chapter of the book, was an all-black unit, and they acquitted themselves admirably during the Battle of the Bulge. So it was a segregated army. The very few combat units that were allowed, the Tuskegee pilots, of course, had, to my knowledge, all had white officers. What is even more disappointing, in a way, of course, it was the time, and it's hard to judge. You know, we sit here in 2025 and are trying to judge people's attitudes and behaviors 80 years ago. The soldiers returning to the South, the black soldiers returning to the South after the war, that I found very depressing in that most of the Southern whites were deeply invested in upholding Jim Crow in the South. And thus, black veterans, whether they were combat veterans or just overseas veterans with several years service away from home, came back to the South, and the Southern whites were very insistent and effective of maintaining the Jim Crow atmosphere and environment. So, for example, they couldn't vote. They couldn't live in certain neighborhoods. They could not eat in restaurants. You know, the whole terrible and almost inexplicable Jim Crow apparatus remained in place in the South, unfortunately, probably until the late 1960s. These soldiers who fought and died, and at the very least served, were terribly treated when they came back home in the South.
That is disappointing. Let's see here. I guess it's about time to kind of bring things to a close here. The book is Jeep Show, A Trooper at the Battle of the Bulge. The author is Robert B. O'Connor. I mentioned it briefly at the beginning, but Bob, could you please tell everyone once more where they can find your book?
Yes, thank you, Eric. The book is on Amazon, and it's also on bookshop.org.
Bookshop.org.
If you like the indie aspect. And then again, the website is jeepshowbook.com. To get more background information. Eric, if you don't mind, I would like to end by reading a very short paragraph that the reporter, the war correspondent, wrote about the American soldiers in his column.
Yes, please do.
America fielded millions of citizen soldiers who disliked the goddamn army, were ambivalent about their officers, and resisted the trappings of military hierarchy, also known as chicken shit. Yet many of them will remember their service as the ennobling experience of their lives. If you ask them, they will tell you they fought not for their country or for lofty ideals, but for each other, for their buddies, to get the job done and get home.
All right. Fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. I sometimes crack up when I read that because I think about my dad and, you know, all those young men and grown men that, you know, sacrificed so much.
Thanks again for joining us. If you liked this interview, make sure you like, subscribe, and comment so we can bring you more interviews in the future. And also make sure to support our guest, Robert B. O'Connor, by purchasing a copy of his book. Not only is it a trove of historical information, but a portion of the proceeds goes to support Shields and Stripes, who in turn supports veterans and first responders. From the History Unpacked team, best wishes for 2025.